bully and a coward, and like most cowards, a hypocrite as well. That is how Alistair Campbell describes the Daily Mail's editor, Paul Dacre. A bit rich, some might say, coming from the former head of communications for Tony Blair. The combative and eloquent King of Spin has a reputation among many journalists for his belligerence. He's widely painted as a bully. YouTube is replete with videos of him going toe-to-toe with a who's who of political figures and journalists. It's clear Campbell has a public platform and voice that few others enjoy. He's now setting about using it to try and stop Brexit. Another of his quotes, recently tweeted, goes, "Unless Brexit gets fucked, Britain is fucked. Zealots, ideologues, cowardly MPs and far-right media, the only ones keeping the fuckery alive." Nothing too explosive. But then again, a recent YouGov poll showed that Britons now think that voting Brexit was the wrong decision in their highest numbers, 47%. I'm Ollie Dugmore, and I wonder, if Tony Blair is the most toxic figure in recent British political history, including Margaret Thatcher, what does that make Alistair Campbell? Oh,
good morning, Alistair Campbell. How are you?
I'm all right.
Glad to hear it. We live in a peculiar world. So much is happening, but nothing is actually happening. The bipolar political picture where Brexit is either a success or a tragedy means we have explosive arguments, infighting, knives in the back, a Prime Minister who is applauded for losing her voice, for her message falling to the ground, but she still resides at number 10. What on earth is going on?
I think what's going on is the reality of Brexit is beginning to dawn. I thought it was really interesting that she apologised at the conference for screwing up the election. I think the person who should be apologising is Cameron. I think the referendum was an act of tactical idiocy. And people, when you say that, people say, oh, that's anti-democratic, the people should always decide. Well, the people can decide, but one of the things the people decide is actually to elect leaders.
Yeah.
And leaders should lead. And what Cameron didn't do was lead in relation to Europe. He called the referendum as a way of helping himself to win the 2015 election. Fair enough, he succeeded. He beat Ed Miliband. And he became Prime Minister without the Lib Dems around his ankles. Fair enough. Mm. But look where it's ended up. So I think what's happening is that the referendum that was meant to, quote, lance the boil on Europe has done nothing of the sort. And the reason for that is that the issue itself, I mean, I think she's becoming the seventh leader of the Tory party that this issue is eating.
Yeah.
And the reason is that they won't confront it. They won't actually stand up to these people. I was on the television with John Redwood yesterday. How do you argue with somebody who said there hasn't been any economic impact of Brexit? How do you argue with that?
Well, they've had enough of experts.
Well, although he did say the experts told him that the planes are going to fly, and it's fine, the planes are going to fly. John Redwood says so. So we're governed by delusion. And I don't know if you saw partly, I'll be honest, it was therapy, but I've written this piece, it was in The Guardian yesterday, and I've done a longer version in The New European. All your listeners should get The New European, subscribe.
I'll make sure they do.
Fight for the 48%. But the point I made was that I think the speech you should have made at the conference was as follows. Part one, why I voted Remain, because on balance, I think that was the right thing for the country. Part two, why I was more reluctant than Cameron and Osborne, because there was lots wrong with Europe and it was a crap campaign. Part three, why on becoming Prime Minister on the back of Cameron's failed adventure, I feel and have felt duty-bound to deliver Brexit, because that's what people voted for. Why I said what I said in the Lancaster speech, why I said what I said in Florence, why I've tried my level best to bring the cabinet and the country together. Part four, I've concluded it cannot be done. And I think that's the truth.
Yeah.
And I think that's what we're seeing. So, and if you listen to the Brexiteers now, they either say, like that idiot Boris Johnson, they either say, it's going to be great, have faith, like in him and Davis and Fox and May, it's going to be great. Or they say, well, we have to do this because the people voted for it. What they've stopped doing is actually giving you any argument as to why this is the right thing for the country.
Or leadership.
Well, there's no leadership at all in the whole country, I'm afraid. That's one of the absolute tragedies because, you know, the opposition are not really doing that much better, to be frank. I mean, they've just gone along with this, you know, because, and they say it's because they're worried about these northern working class seats where people you know, left Labour because of Europe. That's not the only issue that was up there. That's not the only issue. Added to which, if we're worried about losing the working class, the fact is Jeremy Corbyn's success was totally driven by the middle class.
Mm.
It was university towns. It was kind of, you know, I mean, if my local area is anything to go by, it was kind of retired public servants. You know, working class people, they're not just sitting there. Yes, they're worried about and angry about immigration. But, you know, if you can persuade the working class, in my view, that this is the wrong course for them. And that Resolution Foundation report out yesterday, the people who are going to get most hurt by Brexit are the poorest. And I think we've just got to keep the argument, because I do feel it's turning. I do feel the argument's turning. Now, what it needs is leadership in Parliament.
Speaking of leadership, when you and Tony Blair were in office, how much was the anti-EU sentiment that we're seeing now to the fore, and was the idea of a membership referendum ever suggested?
Oh, it was. I mean, it was there, a lot of it media-driven. If you'd have ever said to me, by the way, within 20 years we'll be out of Europe, I'd said, no way. And I'm sure Tony would have said the same. But it was there. Immigration was a big problem the whole way through. We made the case for Europe, but we always had to be careful. And maybe we didn't go far enough in making that case. I don't know. You can look at it two ways. But
even when you were suggesting joining the Euro, that seems pretty pro-European to me.
Tony is without doubt the most pro-European Prime Minister we've ever had. He was much keener on the Euro than Gordon. He was much keener on the Euro than I was. But that was my job, was to project what Tony thought, not what I thought. But I think that we always knew... Do you know what I think the problem was? I think it's less to do with Europe. I think it's the fact that we were very, very positive about the benefits of globalisation. We weren't really onto sufficiently the concerns that people had about the downsides. And I think in the end, this referendum result is as much about the consequences of the crash as it is of Europe. So it was a problem, but it was one that we felt we could manage, and it was. But you know, clearly we didn't, because otherwise. But I do remember whenever there were discussions about having a referendum on this and a referendum on that, and this treaty and that treaty, I do remember the general view, myself, Tony, Peter Mandelson, and others, was that ultimately the only referendum that would have been any real significance would have been in an out referendum. But I think even in having that argument, we were very confident we could have won that.
Mm.
And I think we could have won that. I think David Cameron could have won the referendum. It was a terrible campaign.
He committed to it properly.
Well, and also, I think he campaigned, and he campaigned hard.
Things like not allowing blue-on-blue attacks, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, definitely. And also, I think also setting it up as the big thing was going to be, I'm going to go and get these amazing concessions from Europe, and then you'll see. Well, Europe doesn't kind of work like that. It's very slow, it's very consensual, it's sort of a bit here and a bit there. And so actually, it misunderstood, to my mind, the... Now, that being said, I thought, until the last couple of weeks, I thought, probably Remain will win. I'll tell you when I realised it was going away, was I go to a lot of football matches, I go to a lot of Burnley games, and it wasn't that people were angry, it was that, it wasn't, there were people there who were telling me they were voting Leave, and it didn't surprise me, but there were people there who were telling me they voted Leave, and it did surprise me. And when I tried to persuade them, as I do with anybody that I meet, it was like, I don't care. It was like, I remember one guy saying, I don't care about the facts. I've decided. I don't care about the facts. And that, you know, one of the worst things with the campaign was Gove's, who's meant to be one of the clever ones, saying, you know, we've had enough of experts. That had an impact. And so this thing about populism to me is not about being popular. I mean, Trump is one of the most unpopular people on the planet at the moment.
Yeah.
Outside his own very narrow base in the States. Populism, to me, is when you allow your decisions to be governed by emotion, and in the case of Brexit and Trump, by lies, and by what you want to believe as opposed to what is true, or what might be true, what you could assess to be true.
Mm.
Now, that is madness. That we're into a form of political madness when that happens. And I mean, Trump is the absolute pinnacle of it.
You mentioned the crash, and you also mentioned experts. LSE released a report couple of weeks ago, their economic research centre, that basically attributed declining real-term wages, categorically stated that, in fact, immigration hadn't played a part at all, and it was the financial crash that triggered it.
Yeah, I'm sure. Well, look, immigration became I mean, look, there's no doubt, we've got friends in, you know, who, you know, builders, taxi drivers, painters and decorators, and they can legitimately point to people from other parts of the European Union, poorer parts of the European Union, who've come here and are doing the same work for less. They can point to that. There's no doubt about that. And they can say that as a consequence, their living standards have taken a hit. Some of them have retired. Some of them have changed course. With the taxi drivers, it's much more about, you know, Uber and technology and all that. But these are kind of legitimate concerns. The question then is whether they are best addressed by us coming out of the biggest market in the world.
Yeah.
And the answer to that is absolutely not. But I think what the crash did, and the consequence of the crash, it allowed the sort of Farages, the Wilders, the Le Pens, the Trumps, these, you know, really quite repellent far-right people, to pretend that they're not, and to say, I've got easy answers to your problems. All you need to do is basically hate that person over there, who happens to be Polish or happens to be Muslim, or, you know, and that's the way far-right hate has always worked. And the thing is, it's because in this country we have these wretched right-wing newspapers as well, it's become almost mainstream.
Yeah, popularised it.
Yeah. So you have things that are said and done that, you know, a few years ago, I'm trying to think recently, I saw something the other day that was like, it wasn't even a big deal, it wasn't even any fuss over it. And I was thinking, God, if you'd have said that 10 years ago. So they go on, the right go on about, oh, you can't say what you think anymore, political correctness, blah, blah, blah. Seems to me there's no limits on what you can say.
Yeah.
And I think that is... And so what's happened is all these myths that you have to fight and challenge all the time. You know, the bureaucrats, well, who's elected them? Well, can any of them name who's the permanent secretary of the Department of Health?
Yeah.
Nobody elected him, but you've got to have him running the place. It's just, you know, the army. Who elected the army? Nobody. I mean, it's just a joke, you know, but we don't know who these faceless bureaucrats are, honestly. It's just...
Yeah. You have to look at themselves perhaps a little bit. Again, looking at your time in the corridors of power, how often did Theresa May's name come up? And what about Jeremy Corbyn as well?
Oh, hardly ever. Funny enough, my last two volumes of diaries, from 2003 to 2007, Theresa May was in 2003 to 2005 once, and that was when she was playing politics with David Miliband trying to adopt a child, okay, which was really unpleasant, and Corbyn not at all. And in the one that's just appeared, 2005 to 2007, Theresa May not at all, Jeremy Corbyn not at all, John McDonnell once. So it just shows you how the world has changed very, very, very quickly.
Why do you think that radical change has taken place?
I don't think it's that radical, for a start. I think it's a radical change in that the characters are very, very different. I think with Theresa May, I mean, if you're saying why do I think Theresa May has become Prime Minister, because David Cameron... I've always felt, I mean, I wrote... Sorry to keep plugging my books, but they're in my
it's
head.
It's fine, go ahead.
I wrote a book called Winners. This was before the referendum.
I've read it.
Well, I don't know if you remember, I said Cameron's big weakness was that he confuses strategy and tactics.
OST.
OST, thank you. Objective strategy tactics. Norwegian for cheese, by the way.
Oh, great.
Is it Danish or both? I can't remember. but Europe is the absolute, you know, epitome of that. Tactic. Let's give them a referendum. Where is the strategy on Britain and Europe? So his objective, win the election. You won the election. Well done. Right, but his strategy was what, and his tactics won it, his strategy's lost. And Theresa May had built up this reputation in the coalition of being, you know, this is what, sometimes these myths just develop because somebody's low profile, quietly effective.
At what?
Quietly effective, yeah, exactly. I mean, to be fair, Home Office is a very difficult department.
Probably
to run.
One of the worst briefs you could get, I would say.
Very difficult department, and it didn't seem to be a total disaster. But some of the things you heard about her management style, and I think the thing is that you know, the latest volume of diaries is from Blair to Brown. It's about the transition.
Mm.
And I always thought about Gordon, who was brilliant in many, many ways. But I sometimes he thought that the Prime Minister's office was just a little bit of a leap up from the Chancellor. And I wonder if Theresa May thought the Home Office to the number 10 is just a bit of a leap up.
Yeah.
It's totally different. You've got such a broad canvas on which you have to operate. And also that strength that she had at the Home Office where, you know, you don't mess with Theresa kind of thing. And nobody quite knew her, and nobody knew what she was like, and she was a bit friendless and all that. That becomes a terrible weakness when you've actually got all these relationships you have to manage all the time, and which actually become, you take the European thing now, I mean, you know, unless she can have good relations with these 27 other European leaders, she's not going to get what she wants. That's how it works. That's the real world. People know that from their own lives.
Yeah.
So, and as for Jeremy Corbyn, I think it's, I don't know, it's more complicated. I think there's always been an element on the left that prefers protest to power. So actually they kind of tolerated us because, you know, well, yeah, they're doing sort of some reasonably good things like minimum wage, Sure Start, gay rights, devolution, you know, running the economy pretty well for 10 years. Yeah, as we go, more school, spending on schools. You never hear them saying this, by the way. You never hear Jeremy Corbyn saying Tony Blair did anything good. But
be terrible for him.
They tolerated that. But actually, they always felt that New Labour was a kind of an electoral and strategic device as opposed to a political belief system.
Yeah.
I believe what I believe, every bit as passionate as they believe what they believe. It's just not the same thing. I do believe in strong defence. I do believe that that you've got to run the economy well. One of the things they got away with in the elections, this idea of the manifesto was costed. It wasn't remotely costed. The Tories just didn't attack it.
Yeah.
Because they were so arrogant and complacent about the campaign. So I think it's partly that thing coming from the left. I think also, you know, Tony was followed by Gordon, followed by Ed, followed by Jeremy. It was almost like just a little bit more left, a little bit more left. And it was also, none of them, in my view, defended our record nearly well enough. So if you've got the Tories saying Labour governments are crap, the media saying Labour governments are crap, and the Labour Party not defending what Labour governments have done, why should the public think we're any good at government?
Yeah, you've got the better part of 13 years record to look back
just
on.
Gone. You never hear it defended, you never hear it promoted, it's almost like, you know, if you're a Corbynista, if you're a Corbyn or a McDonnell or a, I don't know, Rebecca Long Bailey or any of these people, if you find your meetings not going very well and it's going a bit flat, throw in a bit of an insult at New Labour and you've got the audience back again.
Yeah.
Well, what's the point of that? You know, the Tories are meant to be the enemy. And I do think on Brexit, I just think that, I mean, that, you know, the line is changing a bit. But it's never been in the DNA of Corbyn and McDonnell and people around them to see Britain's future in Europe. It just never has.
Well, they're Eurosceptic, aren't they?
They're Eurosceptic.
They come from that tradition of Tony Benn. That sort of far left anti-Europe, you know, controlling sovereignty of the soil, losing it.
But it's also about seeing it as something of sort of, you know, it's for the business elites and all that. And but what about environmental protection? What about workers' rights? What about the, you know, the floors below which nobody falls? I mean, so much of that has come from the European Union. And the reason the hard right want rid of it is so they can get rid of all that.
Yeah.
So actually, I think the only argument that I can see that has any merit in terms of coming out of the European Union is the idea that if you felt that you could have more control, but that you could reach outwards. Because we can't... This idea, when I saw Chris Grayling the other day saying we can grow our own food, what happens if I want a fucking banana? Where are we going to get that from? I mean, it's like, you know, there's Pret over there. They have very nice bananas. I want the banana.
I want one of theirs.
Where's that going to get dug in Britain? And so,
South Coast somewhere, maybe Brighton.
Well, yeah, big greenhouses.
Eden Project. Let's clear that out.
Okay, maybe. Yeah, grow up bananas there. I don't know. But I think that, you know, we just... Miriam Clegg said something. I did an interview with her for GQ, and I thought this was brilliant. She said, name me a country anywhere, any time in history, democracy or dictatorship, that built success by governing against the interests of the young generation. So when they go on about freedom of movement, right? Freedom of movement, stop these people coming in. We're stopping our people going out. to 27 countries. So we're one country. And then all this thing yesterday, Redwood, there won't be any economic impact of Brexit because we'll be able to, you know, we'll be able to rebuild markets here, there and everywhere. We'll have to rebuild these markets. We're one country. These other countries, there are 27 of them.
So
the loss that they get from us, this idea that they need us more than we need them, it's one of the many fantasies that drives these people. Don't get me going.
We've mentioned vaguely things that are far right want to see rid of by us leaving the European Union. Could you give a few specific examples of where, if Brexit is going to hurt us, where it is going to hurt us?
Well, I think the big hurt is economic, coming out of the single market. And, you know, of course it's true that Germans want to sell their cars here. And of course it's true that French winemakers want to sell their wine here. But we have, our exports and imports, 45% dependent upon our relations with the EU. For them, the UK is 10%. Now, that's not insignificant. It is significant. But they can go elsewhere to fill that gap much more easily than we can. So the various reports you've seen, I mean, and again, this is the problem. People will believe what they want to believe. But that Resolution Foundation report yesterday talked about 500 quid in terms of price rises. If there are tariffs on food, if there are tariffs on medicines, if there are tariffs on all these, you know, on cars, on white goods, all these different things that we're not going to be able to get access to. If there are all these things that we're not going to get access to in the way that we can now. So that's the first thing, is just that, you know, losing that trade. There's then, I think, the chaos. So John Redwood happily says to me, don't worry, the planes will fly, right? Well, we don't know that because there is no WTO for the skies. It's all about arrangement, air agreements between different countries that control different airspace. And we just don't know what's going to happen. So that's kind of big potential chaos. They're already talking about having to build these vast lorry parks in Kent and in Wales for the big ports because we don't have a customs infrastructure. Mm. So that's the sort of chaos. Then I think there's the whole thing about, so if you're, let's say you're an exporter, let's say you are in, I don't know, chemicals, and your chemicals, you're exporting them to different parts of the world, and let's say the European Union is a big part of your market. Now, at the moment, what you produce is governed by the customs union and the laws that affect the whole of the customs union. So you know that provided you are in line with those regulations, you can ship that to anywhere in the European Union. The day after Brexit, what law is going to govern them? So these firms are going to have to start deciding, well, do we know what regime we're going to be covered by? And if they're not, they're going to start thinking, well, maybe we need to find a new market there already. You know, not for nothing have EasyJet talked, you know, they're shipping out to Austria. And again, Project Fear, it's all Project Fear, it's Project Fear. I do loads and loads and loads of talks on different things in the city. You talk to people down there, and they're doing it, they're planning it.
Yeah.
You know, they've worked out, they've got a year, and they can work out, well, maybe we need to move here and move there. And of course people would rather live in London than Zurich or, you know, Frankfurt. Of course they would. It's one of the greatest cities in the world. But in the end, their business interests will decide.
They've got to look at their 2018 projections.
Yeah. And then I think also the whole cultural thing. I think the fact that you could go and set up business in Germany tomorrow, and then you can't. And I think your generation is much more of that kind of entrepreneurial, get up and go, decide what you want to do and go and try and find it. I find your generation is, you know, when I see it through my own kids, they're much more adventurous in a way and entrepreneurial than my generation was when I was growing up, and I was going to through university and you're very much, you know, get your degree, look for a job,
get your career,
do that. It's very much now people thinking there's, you know, I like the sound of that, I can go and do that and set myself up. You're going to be limited. You're going to be limited to where you can go. And so I find that whole, and then politically, what Brexit says is we're a country in decline. Countries don't look at us in the same way, and that's important. You know, the German election debate, Merkel and Scholz, Brexit, in it was a very long, it was a very German debate. It was serious, it was heavyweight. There were four presenters there. There was no kind of, you know, Paxman-style grandstanding. It was very, very straightforward. And So you'd think they'd go through all the big issues. Do you know that Brexit was not even mentioned?
Was it not even mentioned?
No. Britain was mentioned once. Yeah. And it was in the context of the countries that have had a terrorist attack. So this idea that the rest of Europe is sitting there convulsed by our decision, it's just, you know, so I think we'll lose politically, we'll lose culturally, we'll lose financially, we'll lose diplomatically, we'll lose every which way.
Considering that Burnley have never been in Europe, I find your affection for it quite surprising.
Well, Burnley's a very, very important part of my life. And also, you're showing your age here, sunshine.
Because, oh, right, here we go.
Because Burnley have been in Europe.
Oh, now you're kidding.
When? In the 60s.
Oh, right, okay, well, there we are.
Sorry, that didn't exist, that doesn't count.
Yeah, forget about it.
60s, right. And who knocked us out in the end? I think it was Hamburg. Or it was a German team. I think we beat Norwich.
What a metaphor.
I was supporting Burnley then. I didn't go to the European away games, which is a big loss, obviously, because it hasn't happened since. No, we've played plenty of friendlies in Europe.
Yeah. Perhaps time for a serious Burnley comment then. You mentioned speaking to people at matches and whether you were surprised or not about how they were voting. Burnley voted 2/3 to leave.
Yeah.
Given your affinity for the place, how do you feel about that? And do you think its residents have changed their minds at all in the last 16 months?
I think some will. Most probably haven't. Look, Burnley is... you've got to explain, by the way, I've never lived in Burnley. Burnley, my connection with Burnley is the football club.
Oh, right, okay.
But I know it obviously very well because I go there a lot. Mm-hmm. And look, I understand why... A lot of the people there felt that this is the madness of Cameron's referendum. It was, for a lot of people, it was an expression about their economic living standards, the sense of those living standards going backwards. For some people, yes, it was about immigration and the feeling that the nature of the town had changed, that the area had changed, that they were, you know, the whole issue of undercutting was real. But I actually, what I feel, when you say what I feel about it, I feel sad, to be honest, because you can understand, on the one hand, I can understand the anger they feel at their lives and their living standards falling, but this is not going to help. It's going to make it worse. And what I've often felt about Burnley, this is why the football club is so important in Burnley. If you look at a lot of those towns in that region, there is a feeling of being left behind, and it's real, but there's lots and lots and lots of good stuff going on. It's just a question of how you join that up. Other towns in the area actually have, I think, I don't know how Preston voted.
I assume it was probably Leave, but I don't know.
I don't know, but I mean, but I always feel with Preston that maybe because it's the county town, maybe because, I don't know, they've been, you know, it's got better transport links, that it feels, it has less of that automatic feel that, you know, I talk to friends who support other football clubs who, when they come to Burnley, mm-hmm. they sort of say, God, you do feel like you're going back in time, sort of thing. But the other thing is this, that we talk about leadership. I mean, it's difficult, but when you have next to no MPs going out and saying what I'm saying now, which is, I think we've made a terrible mistake and we've got to change course, people probably aren't thinking about it that much. I mean, a lot of people say, oh, God, every time they mention Brexit on the television, I just want to turn it off, get on with it. Yeah. That's the attitude of a lot of people now. So I think if you had not just people like me and Ken Clark and Tony Blair and Nick Clegg and people that, you know, even though we're relatively young, you know, I'm just turned 60, Clegg's still in his 40s, I think.
Yeah, I think so.
So we're not ancient. But we are, if you like, we have to accept we're figures of a past era. Unless and until you get figures from this era prepared to lead on the message that we have to think again, then why should the public think again?
Who do you want to pick up that torch then?
I think, do you know what? I think whoever picks it up and really, really goes with it, I think there's a chance they'd end up as Prime Minister. I think actually the politician who leads, frankly, any of the parties, if they're leadable in that direction, Labour's the most obvious to me that could be led in that direction. Mm. I do understand why it'd be difficult for Theresa May, but even with Theresa May, I think that would be the making of her. I think if she were to make that speech that I wrote,
yeah,
you can get the full version in the New European, or yesterday's Guardian, or tomorrow's New European. Or I'll tell you what, I'll put it on my website. But I reckon if she did that, she'd have resignations, she'd have people storm out the cabinet, she'd have people tear up their party cards, and I think she'd actually, I think it'd be the making of her. But she hasn't got the imagination to do it. And likewise, I think with Labour. I think Labour are misreading the thing about the election. I think they're misreading it. I think there's... I think people are persuadable. As long as you listen to and address those underlying reasons. So people do want to feel a sense of identity. They do feel their identity being challenged. They do feel immigration is a problem. So address all that, but don't do it in a way that is going to damage the economy, damage your society, and basically reduce us to third division.
I want to look back at a couple of decisions that you made whilst you were in government. How do you look back on the decision to immediately open the UK's labour market to the new Eastern European member states, and do you think it was a mistake?
At the time, no. And here's the thing. This is why, in a way, it's quite valuable to have diaries, because you can actually, you can look back at what you thought at the time.
Yeah.
Today, here and now, I can see that that has been very successfully used as part of the campaign that has led to us voting to leave the European Union.
Yeah.
Therefore, we should have been a bit wiser, maybe. But the other thing, here's the other thing, I think I'm right in this, the only three countries, you have to check this, I think the three countries that did what we did, in other words, allowed them to go in, were us, Ireland, and Sweden or Denmark?
Yeah, I was going to say it was a Danish one, I think it was Sweden.
So, that kind of exposes the myth that we didn't have control, because these other countries, they did put limits on.
Yeah.
Right? We could have done, we didn't. Now, the reason for that at the time was economic need. We needed more people because we were investing in public services. We were building more homes. The economy was going well. The city was saying, we need more people working here. Businesses up and down the country were saying, we need unskilled and skilled labour and we can't get it from our own homegrown workforce. So that's what we were addressing. But, you know, often... best laid plans and all that, and unintended consequences. So when you say, what do I think of it now, I completely understand why we projected it in the way that we did, but I have to accept it's had an impact on where we are now.
By contrast, I wonder if you would call the Good Friday Agreement perhaps the high point of your time in the executive. If that's the case, well, regardless, how on earth can the government reconcile that agreement, in particular its second strand, with Brexit?
Well, you've asked me that question, and I can't give the answer because they haven't given the answer.
Yeah.
And it's absolutely... It underlines the extent to which we just don't have a serious government anymore. I mean, I went to Ireland several times during the referendum campaign, and I was trying to... I was involved in this campaign that the Irish equivalent of the CBI was doing, trying to get people in Ireland to phone... not just relatives, but also business contacts and phone people in the UK to say, listen, this is going to have a really big impact on us. So if you've got any Irish blood, think about us as well, that kind of thing. And I thought it was an absolute scandal that the Irish Northern Ireland point was barely addressed during the referendum. Tony Blair and John Major went there and tried to make an issue of it, but it just wasn't an issue. The media didn't care, the Leave campaign didn't care. David Cameron didn't really kind of, you know, tackle it as a big issue. And I, you know, not to put too fine a point on it, I go to Ireland a lot, especially the south, but also I go to Northern Ireland a bit. And it's perilous. It's perilous. And here we are. I was saying to somebody the other day, right? If you'd had sex with a woman on June the 24th as a way of taking your mind off the disaster that had just happened, right? And if she'd got pregnant, right? And the baby had been born after 9 months, its front teeth would have come through now, right?
Yeah.
So you've got this lovely little baby with its front teeth coming through, and we're still no further forward in answering that question, how are you going to manage the Irish border? We're no further forward. Now, that says to me, either they're not thinking about it, Or it's just join the list of the things that we'll just kind of wish away.
Yeah.
Well, that is not government. That is not government. And I think the European, I think the Europeans were right to pick on the three things that they picked on. You know, the money, settle outstanding obligations. Very, very complicated because you're talking about, you know, agreements, part agreements, some agreements that will go through, pensions and, you know, things that we will benefit from, things that we won't. It's a really complicated thing, but you've got to work that out. And then the rights of EU nationals here and UK nationals living in the rest of the EU and the Irish border. It seems to me they were the right three things to say. We have to sort these quickly.
Yeah.
Well, we haven't sorted them. And what they do now is say, oh, the Europeans are being difficult. They're just not serious. And, you know, if I look back, you know, the Good Friday Agreement, there are several things that have happened in the peace process. I mean, the peace process is in crisis at the moment in that the institutions are not up and running properly. If that had been us, and if that had been Tony Blair and Prime Minister, he'd never be on a plane.
Yeah.
He'd be out there the whole time sorting out. What has she done? Nothing. I mean, can you... You probably can, because you're very, very well informed. Can you name the old Northern Ireland Secretary?
You know what, I can't.
James Brokenshire. Now, I'm not criticising him. He's probably working very hard.
Yeah.
But it means it's not a priority.
Yeah.
Well, it is a priority.
The main bargaining tool at the moment would appear to be no deal. We're trying to leverage no deal as like an option.
That only works, if I can give another plug for the new European, Jonathan Powell's got a piece in there this week.
One of your close colleagues.
Yeah, and who was very, very involved in the, he was Tony's chief negotiator in the Northern Ireland talks. And he makes the point that you can only have that as, you know, saying to them, no deal, well, what's your just better than that alternative? And there's no sense of that. What are our alternatives? They're not stupid, these people.
Yeah.
You know, these people can take the piss out of Juncker all they want. The guy's been round the block a lot. Merkel, Macron. Okay, Macron's a relatively new force, but he's a force.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, we're looking at it all the time through, why don't they do what we want? You know, Juncker, Barnier. Barnier's not stupid. They are working. And what I don't have the sense of, you see, like that dinner the other night when Theresa May goes there. I mean, I'm very good at reading what lines are, you know, people are putting out. And when they said that we're going to accelerate the talks, utterly meaningless. Utterly meaningless. In other words, nothing happened. And they were saying, oh, it's really good news because Juncker's... It reminded me of when, you know, they were really excited when Theresa May went to Washington and Trump said, oh, we're going to get a trade deal with Britain. You know, like, you really trust this guy's word. So, I think we're in a bit of a mess.
One final question.
Yeah.
Being anchored, feeling secure, they play a big role in our mental well-being. It's something you've spoken very candidly and open about. Do you feel that the uncertainty over Brexit has been bad for the mental health of the nation as a whole?
I don't know. Has it been bad for mine? I mean, I'm always very careful about using the language of mental health in things. So, like you said, when people say, I find it so depressing, right?
Absolutely.
But it is actually. I do find it depressing. It depresses me that we are turning our backs on something that actually I think has been very, very good for our peace, for our prosperity, for the opportunities for our kids, and we're taking that away from the next generation. I think that is really, really bad. And I do think that countries do have moods. And I think, I've said, I mean, and I don't, you know, I don't talk about suicide kind of lightly. I'm a patron of a suicide sanctuary, and, you know, suicide is the ultimate mental illness in a way. But I do see Brexit as an act of national suicide. I do. I think we're chopping our own heads off. And I think countries go into decline. And I think in the modern age, because things happen so quickly, I think it can happen very, very quickly.
Mm.
You know, we just had that election in Austria, and okay, because it's, you know, you've got the element of the guy's only 31, who's going to be the Chancellor probably, and you've got the far right involved and what have you. But it was quite a big deal, okay? But not as big a deal as when you used to have the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Well, that went into decline. The British Empire went into decline. We have punched way above our weight for a long, 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 long time.
Absolutely.
And maybe we'll continue to. But I don't think we will. I think there's a real risk Brexit will take us into economic decline, political decline. When Europe is a reality, and when something really big happens in the world now, do they think automatically? One of the acts of leadership is actually you've got to be inside the heads of other leaders. So that when they're making their decisions, they're going to take into account what you think. I don't think they sit around thinking about what Theresa May thinks. I think they did with Thatcher. They did with Tony. It mattered. And we mattered. And I think that will have a big knock-on effect. I think as we come out of the European Union, if we do, and I hope we don't, then I think it'll be very, very hard, given the way that politics is changing around the world, and given that the United Nations was created for a completely different sort of world, very hard to see how the UK and France hold these permanent positions on the Security Council when you've got Germany, when you've got the European Union, when you've got India, when you've got Brazil, when you've got different powers that are developing and different power blocks that are developing. And I think, relevance. And I did a talk at a military establishment recently, and because the military are very polite, the officers and all that, I got a very nice letter from the guy who'd hosted the thing. And, I was actually mainly talking about strategy and leadership and teamship and that, but, we talked about Brexit for obvious reason. And this guy said, you've no idea how dispiriting it is to be a soldier for a country that is choosing to make itself irrelevant. That's a serving officer said that to me, and I thought, bloody hell. But that's what we're doing. That's what we're doing. We're choosing to make ourselves less relevant, and that is just crazy.
That's damning. The clouds hang low over this drizzly United Kingdom today. Who is going to stick their head out and find some sunshine? Alistair Campbell, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it.
Not at all.
You might have heard during that podcast that Alistair is selling several books. He is also the editor-at-large of The New European, and you can go to his website, alistaircampbell.org. Both Alistair and myself are on Twitter. I'm at Ollie Dugmore, OLIDUGMORE, or at Campbell Claret. And as always, you can get the podcast itself on at Brexit Podcast. The Brexit Podcast has been brought to you by Tim Hemming, Jennifer Hahn, Warren Pohl and Ollie Dugmore, with the theme music by the one and only Kevin MacLeod.